Welcome, everybody. Welcome. My name is Dee Slavutin, and we are at the 24th East Hampton Poetry Marathon. We are still standing on the shoulders of Sylvia Chafkin and Bibi Antel. Yes, they did it for a score. Isn't 20 years a score? They did it for over a score, and then I took over. And I hope I can follow in their footsteps. We are being taped today by WPKN, and it's being recorded for East End Inc. on WPKN Radio. And East End Inc. is heard on WPKN 89.5 FM and WPKN.org on the fourth Wednesday each month at 7:30 p.m. And the program is always available online at eastendinc.blogspot.com. You have that information on your seats. As well, the information you have on your seats will help you participate for the next few weeks because we are not always meeting here. So take a flyer if you'd like to participate, and you'll see the schedule of events. We also have to thank, for this beautiful venue, the East Hampton Historical Society, under whose auspices we are operating. Tonight we have two poets. Phil Asoff will be our first reader, and George Wallace. The first thing I want to say to you about Phil Asoff is that I guarantee you he will move you one way or another, because Phil Asoff was a professional mover for 25 years. And then I like to think he traded the M in mover for L in lover, because he's a very romantic poet. I'll give you a formal introduction for him, and then he's given me permission to read one of his poems, and I'll tell you why in a moment. He's a furniture mover for most of his life. Raymond Philip Asoff won scholarships and fellowships to Eckhart College, Bucknell University, and NYU. His stories and poems have appeared in Glimmer, Train, Poetry, The Humanist, Tampa Review, and elsewhere. Off the page, he goes by Phil, and you can find him at Facebook or at philasoff@gmail.com, and his books will be available outside afterwards when we have our refreshments. Okay, so I hoped it wasn't too bold when I asked Phil for permission to read one of his poems. And the reason I asked is there are several reasons, but one of the first workshops I ever took said a poem should be concrete, colorful, colloquial, explicit, and hard. And hard doesn't mean tough, but so it's you can feel how compact and how real those adjectives are for how a poem, quote unquote, should be. Not the only way. But then this poem specifically, the one I'm going to read on Phil's behalf, I stole it from him to read it. I wanted to read because there are four or five reasons. One, there's a vivid sense of place. Two, it captures a primal state of surrender. Three, it unearths where poetry is found. Four, he accomplishes this with one adverb and five adjectives in a 17-line poem. Quite an accomplishment. NYC pizza. Except for God, the woman who sleeps with me, the veins of a maple leaf in all four seasons, and every single note of John, Paul, George, and Ringo, one of the things I love more than anything after humping thousands of pounds of cartons and furniture up five tight turning flights of stairs until far past the right side of midnight, when exhaustion has emptied me of both art and ambition, and my spirit feels slightly dislodged from my body? Is eating pizza in the street in New York City? Because there, at the heart of Western Civ, as I stand on a piece of steaming pavement with that miraculous triangle in my calloused hand, I understand what poetry is as the litter skitters across my sneakers and the stars over the dirty buildings rise, and that the best poems aren't written, but lived. Bill Asaph, please.
I'm really, really grateful to be here. Thank you for having me, Dee. And when Dee and I spoke a day or two ago and she told me that that was going to be the introduction, I asked her if she would write my eulogy. Cake for breakfast. When the maple branches sway and the shade dances, over the front steps where I sit, a comfortable ape, scratching my hairy chest and eating a handful of carrot cake, while scrambling ants in search of crumbs zigzag across the cool black slates, and one, bright black and ticklish, climbs indifferently over the white mountain of my toe just when someone says, "Hello," and I see my neighbor buzzing steadily toward church in her wheelchair. I wonder if paradise is a place we must earn, or what we love here, where the maple branches sway and the shade dances. I opened with a sunny summer poem. The next one is about rain. We have obsessions, right? We write about things, God, love, sex, rain. These are some of mine. This is called Rain Mosaic, and I don't think it needs any notes. If any, Arjuna is the warrior who took counsel from Krishna, who was his charioteer and turned out to be God. I love the sound of Krishna, and I love the sound of Arjuna, and that's the real reason they're in the poem. Rain Mosaic. I have opened the door to listen to the rain. The sound of falling water is the same whether it falls from cathedrals or gutters. When I was 10, already old, I found the face of the suffering Christ composed of oil in a muddy puddle. Rainbow-colored beard and thorns, swirling, staring eyes, open mouth without a voice. What does it mean that I have looked for this in every puddle ever since? In love with the world, yet wanting heaven, unable to learn to just sit still, wanting this and needing that, and always filled with wild silences. Unsure what to pray for or how to act, I have run through the streets in a drenching rain and leapt the fence of a friend who is dead, Megan, whose name became synonymous with heroin. If all things are echoes of the voice for God, what are those watery windows saying? Standing under the aura of a streetlight, watching sweeping sheets of water and little rivers carrying litter down the drains, I believe I understand Arjuna. I too am human, a spirit trapped in this prison of skin, a wind-blown will, still refusing to choose the path of duty or the path of devotion, as Krishna waits in a blue mood for centuries. Rain pelts the green puddles, circles, little infinities, expand and fade. The rain that can be named is not the rain. The hand that signs the page is not the man. Thank you. This poem is called Down in My Body. Here in the woods, my face forgets the shapes it makes when others are near. I slap my fat and lurch like an ape, thudding, crunching on these two free feet. At night, by the fire, I sniff my knees, then wonder what my bones remember as the embers pop and the sparks ascend toward the father fires of the stars. Waking at dawn and yawning happily, I paint my chest with purple berries, drum stumps, smack rocks, then climb a leaning silver tree and swing my weight from its bending limb into the shocking cold of a stream I own, the stream I am, when the current take hold. I'm going to read some from this book. Four short stories and 10 love poems, it's called, mixed media. I wanted to write a poem about marriage, but I was married several times, so I had to put it in the plural. So this poem is called Marriages. Our bodies, sweating, shining like diamonds, reflect the unions of our parents and theirs. I feel them massing in my blood, the mates meeting and pairing down the generations, from the time of the cave, the tree, the sea, and further back, beyond the jeweled black cradle of space, the instinct ghosting us. Above me, arched like the galaxy, you sigh, and your breath spreads across my face like the first wind that seeded the universe. This next poem was fun to write, very fun. It's also a love poem, different in tone. It's a little long, and so you're welcome to take a listening break. I will not be offended by that at all. It's called And Other Things Also. The blue flowers she brought me the second day we made love, still blooming today. And the way the wind lifts the orange leaves of the maples beyond the frame of my dining room window, which she glanced through when she ate some potatoes and peas I made, a dish she called delicious. She is all of these and all of their essences and other things also. Like the white duck in the street, which, on her way over, she ran over, but somehow did not kill. That poor, shocked bird, and all white birds forever, from the heavily symbolic dove landing on the hand of St. Francis to the seagulls in the parking lot of Huntington Harbor, pecking at the scraps of a bagel, have become one with her, the swan with bifocals on the pond of my mind. She's so inclusive and expansive, the laws of physics snap like toothpicks everywhere she steps. When she kicks off her shoes in my apartment, invisible flowers sprout from the carpet. Bouquets of flowers whirl up behind her car when she drives into my town. They rise right out of her exhaust pipe. She's the Beatles and LSD and Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, even when she's almost killing ducks. She's left permanent impressions on the curves of my consciousness. The world is her dress. blowing her nose, painting her toes, or eating my potatoes. She brings new meaning to every single thing, including those nebulous items, which compose more of the universe than anyone knows or is likely to discover before the bang or the whimper we're all supposed to hear when the world that is too much with us ends. And everybody forgives everybody for everything as we catch that last bus to heaven. Look what she's done. She has turned a furniture mover into a philosopher. One who dances with dining room chairs and heavily improved me as a human being. I no longer steal napkins and sugar packets from 7-Eleven. I've cut down on gambling. Yesterday I said a prayer and placed a plastic flower on my mother's Catholic grave. And I didn't yell at the president on television. I just gave him the finger. Ate another fig, and kept reading the Bhagavad Gita. And I appreciate God more than ever, who bubbled the oceans and made the ooze that produced the amoebas, which splashed onto land and lived and mated and mutated as God yawned, and became the monkeys in the trees that swung down and stood up one day and faced each other naked, as she faced me, then scratched themselves into Neanderthals and soon became Sir Isaac Newton and the mother of Mother Teresa. In other words, though even Shakespeare's words would only fit her like earrings from a flea market, she's all those falling dominoes, the sum, the synthesis, and the synergy of each cause and effect, accidental or miraculous, that led up to us taking a shower together on a Tuesday afternoon, then dripping back into the bedroom where the chilly autumn air pouring through the screens made us shiver in our skins. She liked that poem. I've tried to write a few poems about what it's like to be an American. This is one of those. It's called Numb Frenzy. It began with a bagel. Poppy seed. Very lightly buttered. Innocuous, it would seem. But after I'd eaten it, I needed another. The clerk at the cash register was stoned. Gazing up from the stains on his apron, he asked, "Hey, weren't you just in here?" "No," I told him, "that was my twin brother." Then I ordered an everything with cream cheese and jelly while pretending to peruse the horrible headlines. Steering with one knee as I drove downtown, I ate my second bagel like a dog. I was a menace now. Numb with the frenzy. My eyes were magnetized by neon slices glowing in the windows of pizzerias. Bakeries roped me with their aromas. I hid the car behind Big Jack's Barbecue Palace and promised myself I'd have just one wing. After half a chicken, a basket of fries, a Diet Coke, then a bucket of ribs. I hated myself. God, how could I have forgotten I was a vegetarian? I was bad. A bad person. So I drove around the block and bought a cake at the French pastry shop. I will share this with the family, I told myself sternly. But I ate it by the handful behind the wheel as I raced toward the ice cream parlor where the girl there said, "Mister, are you okay? You have like chocolate on your face. I discovered an extension cord behind the counter and bound her by the waist to a plastic chair. Then I locked the door, yanked down the shades, and grabbed a pair of scoopers. It was there they found me, many hours later, in a puddle of cold, hot fudge on the floor. Unconscious. Depraved. American. It's a fun poem. Thank you. This next one is called Blue Silk. As if the rain had taken her hand, she's out of my arms, the robe, the door, then down the steps and into the yard, her curved back new with nakedness. I whisper her name to call her back, but she moves across the wet black lawn under an empty clothesline to touch the bark of an oak. My gifts are small compared to this, the spring rain falling on her rising hands. Standing in the yellow light of the porch, I scan the windows of the neighbor's house. Anyone could see her now. Were anyone awake to look? This glistening woman who dances in a yard where there are no fences. I'm going to read you two more. That poem always felt a little mysterious to me. And the next one has felt mysterious to me every time I've ever read it, but I love it. And others do, too. It was requested today. It's called Intended, and it also is very long, so feel free to take that listening vacation. When the scent and sensation of women first entered me, I knew my deepest need was union. What hunger the other engendered within me, what urgency, as if for air. And the movements of women, even when they were still, were movements I felt in the fields of my being, a rising wind behind the sternum. Now in that wind, one bird is flying, and my eyes follow only it. I have handled things with clean attention, the checkbook, the coffee cup, the cigarette, and the pen. The paper on which the poem is written, when the ink is still a gleaming stream. Things, not ideas, the objects of the world. The face and the razor in the mirror, the sleeves of the shirt I push my arms through, these keys to a car and door I call mine, and an earring of yours I found on the floor when I knelt beside my bed to pray. I have handled things with keen awareness, with the mind of a detective in the presence of Zen, to be sure what I believe is true. We are two who are intended. How hunters understood when roads were overgrown paths in the woods and suburbs were the outskirts close to caves. That is how I understand this now. Within each man a cave remains and an urge he cannot ignore or explain, to crouch at the earth and sniff and search until he finds what he is seeking, what he needs, and makes it his. the way the one whose seed would lead to me stood still in a wilderness which no longer exists and understood a span of ground, a snapping twig, a flash of fur, and plucked a string. Then the lightness of his lifting feet at the sight of it, a flash of fur with an arrow in its neck. This is what it is like, my love. And you are the deer I kneel beside before the invention of religion and the princess bride. You are the end of my hunger. And the hands within me are warm with your blood as I raise them in praise and gratitude to the being we symbolize as being in the sky. This is similar to kneeling in mud in the spring, the damp knees feeling the world that is real and the one that is just behind this one. As you are behind your widening eyes, the eyes in which I see myself beyond thinking, beyond instinct, intended. Waiting at the window for your return, I stare at the stars in our dark backyard, laughing at the tears landing on my cheeks. Years of yearning and wandering are gone. Pressing my forehead against the glass, listening to the traffic as it passes, I am present and I am sane. I feel the weight within my shoes, the pull of gravity, and my feet in warm, wet socks. Yet it seems I have climbed up ancient steps, laid down on a slab of stone, and accepted the knife. And all at once I understand the symbol in the circle, the two shapes chasing the other's tail eternally, the truth that turns, the truth that reverses. Who is the one who dies in this love, whose self collapses like legs in a forest, or the towers of empires? In your receiving, I have been emptied of everything except love. I am the cup you fill, and sip from. There is nothing now I could ever want to have or be or do without you. Without you, every texture would be numb, every syllable the same. Every vision, a shadow on the wall of a cave. And I will read you one more. What my hands want to say. When as now I reach toward your face, I wish my hands were lighter, softer, something other than what they are. The hard hands of a laborer and of one who has lived too near the street, where what is gentle becomes suspended, like the seeds at the heart of an apple. This tart green apple I hold before your mouth. Even as I wipe the juice from your chin while you stare through my eyes, seeing within, I doubt my outer hand is capable of expressing what the inner one intends. And so I hope your temple, cheek, and ear will hear what my stunned touch is stumbling to say, that your nose and right eyebrow will know that when I run this finger along your skin, you reach the place in me where I am finally free of selfishness, a creature surrounded by the field of you. And though the sound that comes from my throat is a growl, I want you to somehow sense that beside you with a tending love in this body that would defend you to its death, a being is seeing your being and hearing the silence in each of your eyes as clearly as the sounds of Om and Amen. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for your
comment. Thank you. Sort of suspended in this place that you create, and it's your reading is very beautiful, very special. Thank you very much. Yeah. Yeah. And while it's a very tough act to follow, I have no doubt whatsoever about our next poet's capacity to follow Phil's excellent reading. So, George Wallace, the poet, I want to take one letter off of his name as well and call him George Wallop, because he like blows your mind, you know, and he can blow your mind. He's a very special and unique talent. He's a professional poet and has actually managed a lifelong career. Besides being a journalist for a period of his life, he's actually managed to be a professional poet and a performance artist for many, many, many years, and that is quite a remarkable feature. So he is currently, he actually is the first Suffolk County Poet Laureate, and he is a Walt Whitman artist in residence. He's the author of more than 30 chapbooks. He has been a radio host on radio poetry programs. He's the founder of Poetry Bay, which is an online poetry magazine. He was the editor of Long Island Quarterly. He was a four-time nominee for the New York Press Writer of the Year Award. He's the winner of CW Post Poetry Prize. And I want to give you some quotes of his own, how he describes himself, and then just pick up some snippets from one review of one of his books. Here's a quote from George. "I've learned about my internal rhythms, to wail when things blow hot and to go more slow in the Blue Cafe, to find a groove, get my boogie down, and dance." He's as playful as a whip. That is somebody else said that about him. Oh, he said, I like this one. He says, "There's a lot of truth in the old line. It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. It's all about the jam." I like this comment, a review of Swimming Through Water. That is one of his books. And the reviewer said, "When you're one line into a George Wallace poem, you know its author." And that for me was very, very powerful. It's like music. We know right away, just it could be a single note and you know where it's going. And so that the capacity to be identified so powerfully and immediately, I thought was a very commanding observation from that reviewer. They said, that person said, "Wallace, who has not only been around the poetry block, but he has built the road to the venue and in many cases the venue itself. He's a journeyman, a major influencer." His major influences for him have been Walt Whitman, Coltrane, and Jack Kerouac. And now just for one more brief commentary about some of his work. This is a review of, as I said, there are more than 30 books, but this is a review of one of them. He invented his own kind of poem, whimsical yet grounded in gravitas that's equally moving when spoken or read, urgent yet full of surreal leaps over the linear and the logical. Wallace's poems breathe the quality of suchness, immediate, ineffable, direct, or as Albert Tazzi phrased it, the eye remains immobile in front of a changing scene. More so, it's entirely of the moment, as self-referential as a train solo. You are sweeping up into a sense of something about to happen. Wallace's poetry takes place in what we Italians, obviously the reviewer was Italian, call the mirror of the impossible dramatization, where the miracle of a conjugation between apparently irreconcilable parts takes place. So, George, do it to us, please. Thank you. Welcome, George Wallace.
All that and a white jacket, too. It's a nice house, beautiful place. It's a lot cleaner than the barn that we read in Huntington. I want to congratulate you, Dee, on continuing this really important work, you know, for poetry on the East End. I remember reading for Sylvia at the Maritime Museum, whatever it is, in Amagansett. Good place, too. This really quality, so thank you for doing that. Glad to see PKN in the house. I'll look forward to tuning in when this is on. PKN is very supportive of not only poetry, but folk music and blues and popular music. They come out to Bradstock every year. Russ, you know this guy from Bradstock. You've seen him out there putting the mic out for us. So thank you for coming out today, PKN. I would say that, you know, it really is a great honor for me to read with Phil. We've been 3 decades together, 30 years ago in 1988 when I returned to Long Island. He had no hair, and I had hair. So I've joined him in that. So. And his approach to writing is really very, very, very different from mine. But, I have a lot of admiration for Phil's work. I prepared 25, 30 minutes worth of material, but it moves quick. You know, if I first person whose eyes drop, I'll know that I have to cut it down. I'll just say one other thing, that the East End has been very important to poetry for many years on Long Island, regionally, and important for New York City as well, especially Canio's. It's great to see the Canio's is still going strong. Canio, like myself, was an up islander. He was from Huntington, and he was a romance teacher. He taught Italian and Spanish at Harborfields High School. And when he discovered this little shop out here in Sag Harbor, he immediately knew that this had to be his other profession. So he did his time both in Huntington and in Sag Harbor. And like I said, when I returned to Long Island and started doing poetry, there was very few opportunities for poets to get together and do something in poetry in venues. And Connie was doing that from the get-go. He had Friday night events, Saturday events, right from the very beginning. Very generous, very democratic, and very lucid in his mixing of different writers together. He's sorely missed, but I know that they're doing a good job of continuing that at Kanye, so long may that reign. Bop with the big boys. 4:45, another day, walks in, diner's getting crowded, same damn truck drivers, same damn scene, shoe salesman with his tired jokes, wives without husbands, husbands without wives, an exhausted teenager on the run and running out of room. Couple of jazzed up hipsters with their burnt out angels trying to split the last ounce of joy when day walks in and grabs itself something good to eat, something nourishing, something necessary, something fine, anything that can restore the original music of the spheres. that plays inside every man, woman, and child before the sun goes down, I mean. Before the sun goes down and the shit starts happening again. Like it does every night all over this sad, beautiful town. Oh, you're a countertop waitress. And I'm a boy with a sink full of pots and pans waiting for me in the back. But when you smile at me across the big, bright, blue countertop like a new lit cigarette, I smile back and we are in love. We're in love like a pair of space rocks circling each other in a cold embrace, like two tortured sailors looking for a safe place to land. And you say, let me tell you about this dude who has been telling me what to do. Well, everybody thinks that they can tell us what to do. Well, girlfriend, I got news for you. Screw that astronaut and his ship he rode in on. Tonight belongs to you and me alone, you and me alone, and I do not know where I'm going to touch you first. You are the jewel in my sky, and all I really want to do is bop with the big boys. Please. This poem's for Bridget Murnahan. Many years a staple figure in Greenwich Village. She ran the poetry open mic at Back Fence. She's wonderful. Member of the Beat Generation, one of the women who was prominent in the Beat Generation, and until very few years ago was instrumental in this poetry reading series. But increasingly cranky. Year by year, she got crankier and crankier. But I met her in this situation. I called her Gaslight Angel. This poem is for the Gaslight Angel who could brighten every joint in the East Village. I met her in McSorley's bar full of onion eaters, bright as streetlight, uncanny and smart, smart as an NYU dropout, crazy with the heat. It was mid-July. She never got her chance, she said. She never got her shot, she said, hurrying from one crowd to another, a waitress job across town, or the rain falling, naive, corrosive, and sad in Cooper Square. This town was perfect for her. Everyone in a hurry, nobody noticing anything, but she turned heads. I remember her standing outside the San Remo with the baby in her arms. A cop tore his badge right off of his shirt, and he handed it to her. He said he wanted to give her something to remember her by. She was everybody's darling, pretty as Paris by the smoldering blue cobblestone sand or sitting by a window in a neon cafe eating a tangerine. She could charm the paint off a politician. Young snakes leaped out of every basket. The Cote d'Azur had nothing on her, nothing on her. And those hands raced in circles when she talked, like two frightened horses snorting with the equine pleasure of her company. All the young bucks sweaty, apocalyptic, methodical, and her, with that wonderful smile, working the sawdust crowd for tips. I knew she could see right through me, like Superman through a brick wall. But she made me feel like the last piece of a jigsaw puzzle. She put me back together. She made me feel like spun gold or lost treasure, the unspeakable glory of her attention. Like a kid caught with his fist in a jelly bean jar. Guilty, clever, irrelevant, and rare. Thank you. This is after 9/11. It was easy to drive into the city. Didn't get so much traffic on the BQE. Stuck on the BQE thinking about Jimmy Schuyler. Sunday afternoon, 1:30 p.m. on unaccountably, crawling southbound on the BQE towards the Williamsburg Bridge instead of flying along a highway like a man ought to do. Man ought to be able to fly along a highway anywhere in America if he's driving anywhere else. But here we are in the pothole capital of the world, driving over the rooftops of Brooklyn, stuck in traffic, even though it's Sunday afternoon in winter. The economy's in shambles again. The big rumbling engine of America has run out of gas. It's been abandoned on the side of the highway. America is sitting on cinder blocks on the side of the road like it used to do, Like one of those cards back in the day, abandoned on the Cross Bronx Expressway by some sucker from the suburbs, and the local boys have already pounced on it and stripped it down. And I'm thinking how, if this was back in the day, I'd be living in New York City with the art critics and abstract expressionists. I wouldn't be pouncing on abandoned cars like the boys in the South Bronx. I mean, if it was 1950-something, I'd be drinking beer at the Cedar Tavern with Jackson Pollock and Franz Kline. I'd be working the front desk of MoMA like Frank O'Hara. I would be cruising the streets with crazy Chester Kallman, staying with people here in the Hamptons, making friends with W.H. Auden and Fairfield Porter. I would be doing it like Jimmy Schuyler did it. I would be back in the day, and the sexy trucks would be rolling up the avenue for me, like they did in Schuyler's poem, February, just rolling away into the sky, like all the hot young lovers that rolled into and out of Jimmy Schuyler's life. But I'm not Jimmy. I'm not Jimmy. I'm not Jimmy Schuyler. I'm not living back in the day. I'm living the now, even though it feels like February. The way old Jimmy described it in his poem, his very good poem, February, with his tulips trying to open up and his women jiggling babies in windows with their tight little eyes. No, it's not February. It's March 15th when I wrote this poem. I'll be 60 years old when I wrote that poem. Next week, 60 years old by the time Jimmy Schuyler was this old. Most of the important people in his life were dead. Bunny, Frank, Jimmy LeSueur, he had diabetes. The American Academy of Poets had elected him fellow. They were handing that boy $10,000 a year, if you can believe that. $10,000 a year. We're talking about the 50s. And all I ever get from those bastards is notices that I ought to be a member, or else I was a member, but now I'm no longer a member because my membership's about to expire, and I'm wondering, where are all the important and dead people in my life? What if I could get $10,000 a year from the Academy instead of paying them $35? How can a man even see the UN building the way Jimmy Schuyler said that he did in that poem? Because from where I'm sitting here on the BQE, that building looks like a big bad box of American cereal to me, not a green wave in a violet sea. It's a perfectly good image, but I mean, what was old Jimmy Schuyler thinking about when he said that? What angle was he looking at the damn building from? I mean, was it the sun or maybe smog in his eyes? What was he trying to see? I mean, look at that. It's a terrible building. The UN building is terrible. I suppose there's some angle. It doesn't look like an IBM card from, or a big ugly box of blind American Kellogg's cornflakes. Maybe from some angle it looks like a big damn keyhole in the sky. That if you find the right key and you jiggle it just right, you might open the door to eternity. I'm thinking, they don't leave holes in the New York City skyline the way they used to, do they? They don't leave them there for very long. I mean, they just fill him up with something new. But then again, maybe Jimmy Schuyler did see something I do not see. Maybe Jimmy Schuyler was onto something. Maybe he could see something. Maybe there would be a big hole in the New York City skyline if you took the UN building away. Like death put a hole in the sky the day it took Jimmy Schuyler away from the rest of us. Because after all, a lot of people I know miss Jimmy Schuyler a lot. And they talk about him all the time. And even though I never knew the man, I know them. So sometimes I talk about him too. Thank you. So Jimmy and Frank O'Hara spent a lot of time out here. Just to shift gears, I'm going to read you a Jimmy Schuyler poem and a Frank O'Hara poem. This one's definitely New York City. Frank O'Hara, step away from them. It's 12:20 in New York, a Friday, 3 days after Bastille Day. Yeah, it's 1959. I go after, get into shoe shine because I'll get off the 419 in East Hampton at 7:15 and then go straight to dinner. I don't know the people who feed me. I walk up the muggy street beginning to sun and have a hamburger and a malted and buy an ugly New World writing magazine to see what the poets in Ghana are doing these days. I go on to the bank and Miss Stillwagon, first name Linda, I want, sir. It doesn't even look up my balance for once in her life. And in the Golden Griffin, I get a little Verlaine for Patsy with drawings by Bernard, although I do think Hesiod translated Richard Lattimore, or Brenda Behan's new play, or Le Balkan, or Les Nègres of Genet, but I don't. I stick with Verlaine after practically going to sleep with quanderiness. And for Mike, I just stroll into the Park Lane liquor store and ask for a bottle of Striga. And then I go back to where I came from, to 6th Avenue, the tobacconist in the Ziegfeld Theater, and casually ask for a carton of Gauloise and a carton of Picayune and a New York Post with her face on it. With her face on it. And I'm sweating a lot by now and thinking of leaning on the John Doe in the five spot while she whispered a song along the keyboard to Mal Waldron, and everyone and I stopped breathing. That's for Billie Holiday. And Jimmy wrote this about a garden here in the Hamptons. It's a beautiful poem called Korean Mums, Chrysanthemums. Beside me in this garden, they're huge and daisy-like. Why not? Or oxeye daisies, aren't they? Or chrysanthemums, shrubby and thick-stalked, and the leaves pointing up the stems from which the flowers burst in sunbursts. I loved this garden in all its moods, even under its winter coat of salt hay. Or now in October, more than half gone over. Here a rose, there a clump of aconite. This morning, one of the dogs killed a barn owl. Bob saw it happen, tried to intervene. The Airedale snapped its neck and left it lying. Now the bird lies buried by an apple tree. Last evening from the table, we saw the owl huge in the dusk, circling the field on owl silent wings. First one ever seen here. Now it's gone. Dream, just remember. Dogs are barking. In the studio, music plays and Bob and Dara paint. I sit scribbling in a little notebook at a garden table, too hot in a heavy shirt in the mid-October sun, into which the Korean mums all face. There's a dull book with me, an apple core, cigarettes, an ashtray behind me. The rue I gave Bob flourishes. Light on leaves, so much to see. And all I really see is that owl, its bulk troubling the twilight. I'll soon forget it. What is there I have not forgot, or one day will forget? This garden, the breeze in stillness, even the words, Korean mums. Jimmy Scholar. I'm headed to the Rio Grande Valley in a couple of weeks to commune with the poets, find out what they're up to. In preparation for that. Also, as it happens, there's a nest of bald eagles in Centerport. I don't know if you guys know this, but first time ever, a nest of bald eagles in Centerport, and the photographers on Facebook, you can find the Friends of the Bald Eagles in Centerport on Facebook, and they're great, great photos of them. But they say they won't tell where the bald eagles are because they don't want crowds to come and disturb the bald eagles. But, I mean, all you have to do is go down there and look for people with these, like, 450, you know, whatever lenses. And they're all standing in one place. It's impossible not to find them. Anyway. Somehow I conflated these two things, as bald eagles and centerporting going to the Rio Grande Valley. And I wrote this poem called Now I Am with the Eagles. Below me the plains, towns, farms, cities. Below me the fields, men, tractors, and wagons and fields. Fussy, intolerant, mute, rude, society is a mop. It disappears rudely down aisle 3. I utter this prayer, and the moon is freed of clouds. I am illuminated, electric, caught in the heraldic, self-sustaining, and I am a circular thing. I'm a clover leaf in the architecture of going, the mystic trefoil, a charging animal that remains in place and knows no bridle. I am a seed in early sunlight, unstoppable. I am hoofed to dust, natural, furious, uncontained, indifferent to you and your human government, defiant before you and your weapons, and now I am one with the eagles, and you control nothing, with your ego and your puny guns, with your gross intolerances, with your associations. This is my prayer. To take the deeper breath. To seek only the compassionate, the higher reward. This, my prayer, to be one with the eagles in the sun and rain, the rush of oncoming wind and illusion, to be cliff diger, huntress in the gorge, oblivious to gravity and rocks, the air welcoming brace to me. I touch a match to God. God touches me back in his name, and this flame belonged to heaven. Breath is an ascending fractal of light. And I am wingspan, and I am an offering, a persistent breeze that crosses a mountaintop. And the face of the Buddha widens and widens into a perfect smile circular. And yes, there is great hope in what lies behind, beyond knowing. Absences too, and so it goes. My heart heretical, my spirit dangerous. Now I am above laws and earthbound churches. Now I am with the eagles and terrible, and government diminishes. These talons are real. Do with me what you will. Heaven is endless. I reside here now beneath heaven. Now I am with the eagles. Now I am also endless. This next one, I confess that I took an image from Phil. I remember a long time ago, he used to go upstate and, with Bruce Johnson and take off his shirt and go walking through the forest, you know, with his shirt off, and he was very proud of that. And I like the idea of, you know, doing that. So, he's so tactile, isn't he? I sat on that for like 20 years before I stole it. And the only reason I saw it is because I started teaching up in Westchester, and so I was driving, I was crossing the Whitestone Bridge and going up the Hutch to Valhalla, and I thought I was upstate. You know, it's Westchester, but I thought I was upstate, so I thought I was in the wilderness. And so I wrote this poem, October. This is the first year I started teaching there. October runs like a bebop Shakespeare. October doesn't matter much to me anymore, not in the city with its heavy-handed women, its lazy umbrellas, long green mushroom people, not in the suburbs with its doormats and SUVs. Autumn does not do it like it used to. I need to go upcountry, pop wilderness into my mouth, cohabitate with the psychedelic earthworms, be one with mushrooms that glow, get post-apocalyptic jam to the jar and back again, juiced with the fennel, go au-courant with a hog-eyed snake and cozy with crab apples. The rainy, dark pulp of autumn's my resurrection. I drool it down my neck. Away with the ugly-ass city and its men in sheep's clothing. Away with dead zone advertisements and terrible manners. Come agitate the gravel with me, brothers, sisters. I know the devil when I see him. Devil, have your day. Go ahead, spit back at man and his work. But devil, leave the gods alone, leave the gods alone. When a man returns to the wilderness, he becomes a little god. When a woman returns to the wilderness, she becomes great lord to another day dawning. Earth is a swollen, playful thing when death seems near. Earth's belly is full and alive with plenty of rhizome, yet for you and for me, spawn of three-seated mercury, asters, tick-seed, goldenrod. Let's weave with the chipmunks. Let's slime along like an omnisexual slug. Let's go spindle to mole, mold to molecule, man to man, cloud to toe, and back again. It's all right here in the fallen leaves for the asking brother. All right here with a bug's sister. Bees, bugs, rain, death. Death and brilliant transfiguration. So, tra-la to the sugar maples. Let's go running like bebop Shakespeare in deep October. Naked through the forest with hairy armpits and bosoms flying while tulip trees do their academic dance and the heavy-scented dew sly in the mist and crafty dew. Let's go up country with the newts and the possums throb and stomp in the wild grapes. Let's go scour the underbrush, foxy as musk, roll in autumn rust with the woolly bears. I'll do it with you. I want to drink with you, sister. Drink your eyebrows up, your curly hairs, your ample architecture. I want to taste you, brother. Devour the sweat and bare fat on your dirt-flaked chest. Stride manfully with me, manfully through the wilderness. Only the boldest rituals will do. I think I got time for two more. I think we'll do a praise for modern women. And this one I stole from, this first image of this I stole from Napoleon Dynamite. It's a movie in Napoleon, it's a cult classic for high school people. And anybody know Napoleon Dynamite? Yeah, you do. Well, Grandma, right? She goes out and she's dune bugging. She goes on the dune buggy on the sand dunes, and she's like, you go feed the llama, I'm going out and eat your quesadillas. I'm going out with my boyfriend to go on the dune buggy and stuff. So, you know, this image of Grandma out there on her dune buggy, like totally, you know, free and wild and achieved, was stuck in my head. Off-road, four-wheel, busted up collarbone, because you did break her collarbone. Roll bar, Miss America. She loved to dune buggy. She loved to ride. She loved to be outside of herself. She loved to spit and cry and hop like a toad, to burn like a barn, to shoot like Novocaine. She spit in the bushes. She spit on the mountaintop. She was on the prairie, on the bayou, in the mouth hole of the universal universe. She loved Shenandoah, Mississippi, Oklahoma, Tuscaloosa. She loved Hot Wheel, all-weather, souterrain, space jam blues. Top down, hood up, piston-busting woman of the blue sky, her rack and pinion, tie-tack, shoe-shine, shotgun, home on the range. No, not the kind you cook on, and no, she loved her own thick hair like nobody's business. She combed it back. She let it go wild. She tossed it back like a steel drum band, like a backdoor Catholic, prophylactic, Mormon, figure-eight, pagan, little Miss America, crazy, drunk, or spying on her own sweet self. Oh, no! No, 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 Miss Fourth of July, drunk by the campfire, girl by the embers. Do not go out on you, not on you. Not the lights of Broadway, not the pool hall lights, not the jailhouse lights, or the junk lot lights, or the headlights, or the supermarket lights, all night long in the supermarket parking lot. And oh, her mulish temper. And oh, her talking back. And oh, her racked up men with metallic skin. Skinny men, fat men, muscle-headed men, gold bond men. No one could stop her. No grease gun Jake, no feed bag Joe, no coat ducks, dipstick, tin shield, sawdust sheriff. And here's what's important. She loved herself, her body, her muscle, her calves, her skin, her ankle, her hip high, high-heeled boots. She shuddered and waved like the prairie grass that she secretly wanted to be. She loved to be outside herself. She loved, and she loved, and she needed to be loved, and she shoved it around. She shook it out. She got lost, got rediscovered, wasted and found, ripped open, given away, put on a pedestal, took for a ride, stolen in the night. She yanked it all out. Every ounce of it, the flesh, the earth, the river, the rain, the red rock forest of oak, she plummeted like these eagles right here. She drew like silver corn. She spooned up asphalt and plowed it back under. She trucked it away, and she bombed, and she bombed, and she bombed, unfairly, unwisely, arrogantly. It's normal. It's faulty and human. It's American, too, and acted foolish when she wanted to and wise when you didn't expect it. Off-road, four-wheel, busted up, collarbone, roll bar, Miss America, tossed her helmet 50 feet in the air and caught in her hand just like this. Big Yahoo, pop fly, six-pack, beanbag of a woman. Headphones blaring, dung busting, shit crazy, headed off to anywhere, doomed as a devil dog. Little Miss American paradise leaped out of the darkness and into the sun. I used to stop with that one, really. But I'll do one more. This is really a tribute to Neil Cassady. was up with my friend Ara Rotala. He had an organic farm on the Merrimack River up in New Hampshire for many years. And he went to school at Naropa. He started the magazine there, Naropa, which is Jack Kerouac School for Disembodied Poetics. You know, it's a very hip dude. And he has this organic farm right there in the Merrimack, and it would flood, and so it had really good alluvial soil, and he would grow unusual crops, and he would sell half of the crops to high-end shishi stores in Boston, and he would give away the other half of the crops to the food banks. Endives, and I don't know what, you know, I couldn't possibly tell you what they were. It was a very hip dude. Anyway, so I was there, and his wife and my wife were skiing, and we were in the house, and we were drinking Jack Daniels. And it had a high ceiling, sort of like this. And he said, "George, I have something very unusual. I want you to hear this. It's a tape, or it's a, you know, it's a, of Neil Cassidy. You know, Jack Kerouac and Neil Cassidy on the road. Neil Cassidy is the character who's, you know, crazy and fast moving and everything like that. And I want you to hear this tape." And so we turned on this tape, and I was drunk at this point anyway, right? And the tape, the speakers for the thing were up in the rafters of the house, so I couldn't hear it properly. But sure enough, it was Neil Cassidy, and I don't know, I think it was Ken Kesey had recorded him. You know, Ken Kesey, when he was on the road on Further with that bus called Further, and they were all doing acid, and, you know, Neil Cassidy was completely imperturbable. Didn't matter what you put into him, it couldn't keep him from being lucid in his own crazy sort of Colorado way. And he would juggle. He would juggle pins, like, you know, bowling pins, and do monologues while he was doing this on stage. And it was one of those monologues that they tried to record. And I was like, I was drunk, and it was Neil Cassidy, and half of it didn't make sense, and I couldn't hear properly. Anyway, I'm sort of deaf as it is, you know, so I picked up like a word here and a word there and a word there, but it was the rhythm, it was the music, which you mentioned at the outset, Dee, which I did pick up, and that's what I did the next morning with a hangover. I wrote this poem called "This Redhead of My Sudden Acquaintance." So there may be a word or two or a phrase or two that actually was recorded and I picked up. Opportunistic, it's found aspects of the poem. And I want to thank you for your attendance. I'll read this and I'll be done with you. "This redhead of my sudden acquaintance. Well, what do I mean to say? The road was straighter than this one. I was driving unreasonably fast as a 57 Chrysler Imperial boy. You remember those? Cherry red, souped up electric windows, electric top, chrome grill, big damn fins, a 57 Chrysler. But no brakes. It had no brakes, man, and you had to scuffle your feet along, take you 3 miles to roll if you wanted to stop, and there would be rocks flying everywhere. You might need a new pair of shoes by the time you were done and by the time you'd stop, because, anyway, I could not afford tires, as my situation, concisely speaking, was dire, if not to say extreme. But being that it was, I could, of course, have gone around the corner, that is to say, steal something secondhand, but at the time, I was with this redhead of my sudden acquaintance. Well-positioned in town, she with a well-oiled boyfriend, me with plenty of time on my hands, but no, he was not in tow on that particular morning. In fact, she had been sitting in the booth at the diner a very long time at this point. By the appearance of things, it seemed that way. There was coffee cups, ashtrays full of nervous cigarettes, and she was putting hairpins into and out of her hair, and I struck up a conversation. It got to be this, got to be that. Everything was going along pretty damn fine, and when I looked outside, as sure as we are sitting here right now today, it had stopped raining. Morning was nearly over. The cat was out of the bag, so zippity-doo, he was off. Both of us shot out of the barrel, and that was that. That was that. We were traveling 10 times faster than it's legal. 10 times faster. I'm talking 35 plus 35 plus 35. And then someone goes, "Yeah, man, I don't mean that road outside of Fort Collins. I prefer at this late stage to say it was one of them back east headed for her hometown in Kansas. She was a school teacher of good repute, not a cop car to be seen. The breeze was everything. Eastern Colorado was a sight to see. She was smart, and with that orange sky. No, not like the red in her hair, a coppery sort of red like Lincoln's pipe on a new shiny painting. She gave me the prettiest smile just then, the prettiest smile. Boy, you could just feel it. That car wanted to fly. We rolled down the windows. We beat to the beat on the dash. "Oh, my," she said. "Oh, my. My right toenail," she said. "Oh, my. I do believe it has just had an emotion." Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, George. So two extraordinary poets to kick off.